Hey everyone, Cy here with our final session on our podcast on How to Study the Bible. I'm here with our guest teacher.
Hi everybody.
Mark Scott here, and we are going to review a little bit. So we're talking about principles for interpreting really anything, but specifically how to study and how to interpret the Bible. We've talked about always interpret in light of context, of what paragraph is around the verse that you're looking at, what passage, what chapter, what book, what's the whole context of the book. Always interpret in light of the meaning of words. What does this word mean throughout Scripture, by this author? Always interpret in light of parallel passages. What do other passages about this topic say that you can help kind of give clarity to the verse that you're studying? And lastly, always interpret in light of the historical background. Every one of these books of the Bible are written to a particular people with a particular worldview. And so this last session, the title of it comes from a French word, genre. So what in the world are we talking about here, Mark?
Well, yeah, right. Cy, this might be the only French word I know. I don't know French, and I'm about as bad on Spanish. But genre is a French term that just means type of literature. That's the bottom line. So the principle we're advocating in this podcast is always interpret in light of the type of literature we're dealing with. Now, we've already said, of course, to our listeners that the Bible's a big book, and therefore it contains several different types of literature. And the reason that we must pay attention to those types of literature is that recognizing the genre, the type of literature, of a text sets the expectations for how to interpret it. Now think of just how knowing the first few lines of a given genre kind of sets your grid for how to interpret that piece of literature that you're dealing with. For instance, Cy, if I say, okay, two guys walk into a bar, immediately you know right out of the gate that this is humor.
That's right.
Is a joke.
Yeah.
Or if I say, okay, the party of the first part addresses the party of the second part, you and I might be lost, but that's legal mumbo jumbo.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody realizes, oh, okay, this is like the reading of a will or something, so we've got to pay attention to what the lawyer tells us. Or this one, roses are red, violets are blue. Okay, immediately we know poetry. So when we recognize how a piece goes, the type of literature it is, that sets the grid for how we do the interpretation.
So it sounds like this genre thing actually is a part of our everyday lives. We use it all the time. Maybe even we're not even aware that we're doing it.
I think that's true. In fact, that would be true really, as you said earlier, about all the principles of Bible interpretation. They relate to interpreting anything that's written, really. We employ this one especially without much thought. And sometimes we do it intuitively. We just know by virtue of how it comes at us that it's going to be interpreted in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Again, other examples might be once upon a time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we know that story and probably fairy tale story. The president at the college where I work, Matt Proctor, had to have ways of indicating to his children whether or not this was going to be a story that was make-believe or a story that was true. So when he put them to bed at night, if he wanted to tell them a story that was make-believe, he would say, once upon a time, and they knew that it was made up. If he wanted to make sure they understood this could be a true story, he would start out like, in a land far away, you know, a long time ago, in a galaxy far away, he would start it that way to make them know that maybe it was true, in fact. Or if we were to say, as opposed to once upon a time, 47 years ago, Okay, immediately he realized that's Abraham Lincoln, that's the Gettysburg Address. He's giving this address that deals with conception and life in a cemetery where there had been a battle and there was death. So we interpret based on the type of literature we see. Now, we've mentioned this kind of example before in our podcast, but remember going back to a headline that we talked about in one of the earlier podcasts, Lions Destroy Indians.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's on the front page of a newspaper, you might think, boy, did some lions get out of the zoo and destroy some Native Americans? You know. But if you see it on the sports page, it's all different.
Mm-hmm.
So that would relate to both context and genre.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get to the Bible.
Okay.
Let's talk about this genre thing. We see it all around us. We use it even though we don't necessarily name it before we use it or think that we're using a genre at the time consciously. But how should we use genre in interpreting the Bible?
As we start with that, so I'd like to give an analogy that might help. I know it sure helped me to think this through. In a book by Stephen Smith, that's a preaching book, really. It's entitled Recapturing the Voice of God. Hmm. What he says is the Bible shows us that God changes his voice. God changes his voice from time to time. In other words, different types of literature. So he likens it to a railroad car in a train. And I think it's a really helpful analogy. You got a lot of cars that make up a train, but they're different. Hmm. Now, around here in Joplin, Missouri, we see these big coal cars coming out of Wyoming, you know, that bring us a better grade of coal to, you know, heat our homes, etc. But a lot of those are just the same kind of car. But you look at your average train, not a passenger train, but a freight train, and you see coal cars, you see oil cars, you see flatbed cars, you see box cars, all kind of cars. And here's Stephen Smith's point. The car, the individual car on that train, is shaped by what it's carrying. Hmm. That's genre in the Bible. And it's so important. In fact, I can't think of a significant book on how to study the Bible in the last 20 years that didn't have a chapter or two on this subject, on genre. Think of it just like a different type of car in a train if the whole train is the Bible.
So, okay, so I get this types of literature. Another way that I like to think about genre is the genres of music. A song, you know,
that's
you can
good.
Talk about a guy talking about his truck and his dog and fishing.
There you go.
I know it's a country song.
There you go.
And we think about genres all the time. So what are the different types of genres in the Bible? What are the big ones we should be aware of? Because it's not just one book and one type of genre.
That's right. And this can get kind of involved, I suppose. I want to make it as simple as I can. I want to put the cookies on the low shelf here. So in an effort to keep it simple, I'm going to take just the three major ones that Stephen Smith mentions in his book, Recapturing the Voice of God. He said in the broad sweeps of genre, there are really just three types. Hmm. One is story. Hmm. One is poem / wisdom. And then one is letter. Hmm. Now, really, when I first read that, I thought, now, wait a minute. There's a lot more than that. And yet, I got to thinking, really, all the ones you drill down farther for could be put in those three categories. Hmm. So to keep it simple, maybe as we read our Bibles, we should just say, is this story-like? Or is it poetry-like or wisdom literature-like? Or is it like epistle or letter? Hmm. Now, let's drill down just a little further in those three areas. When we do that, then Stephen Smith branches it out to these nine areas. Hmm. So under the umbrella of three, we have, you know, I guess you'd say six other ones kind of underneath that. One would be Old Testament narrative. Hmm. That's different than gospel literature, but there are stories in the Old Testament. Number two would be legal passages or law, what one scholar calls constitutional literature. Hmm. This is kind of like the Declaration of Independence or the U.S. Constitution for an American. For the Jews, it would be the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, all the laws. Thirdly would be poetry. Fourthly would be prophecy, which, by the way, uses a lot of poetry. Mm-hmm. Wisdom literature, short sayings, proverbs, pithy little statements of general truth. Epistles, now that's big because 21 of the 27 books of the New Testament are letters or epistles. Then there's this big word, apocalyptic, from the Greek word apokalypsis, which means to unveil. It's the type of literature we see in the book of Revelation, some in the book of Daniel, some in the book of Ezekiel, a few other spots of the Bible, but it means symbolic language. I just think that's the easiest way. Then eighthly, there is gospel texts, gospel genre, or acts. Hmm. They're kind of narrative, but kind of not.
Yeah.
And then finally, discourse, when somebody gives a sermon. Now, even then, you can just keep drilling and drilling and drilling, and you can see other ones. For instance, if we just took the eighth category, gospel or acts, you could just say, well, gospel genre alone includes narrative, parable, miracle story, discourse, encounters, like Jesus with the woman at the well, birth stories, genealogies, passion and resurrection stories, wisdom sayings of Jesus, and enigmas, just strange sayings. The Bible, in other words, is really rich on this. Let me illustrate it with one little text. And that would be, let's just take Mark 4:35-41. This is where Jesus has been teaching in parables all day long. He's bone tired. He gets on the boat with his disciples. In fact, some of the messages and parables he gave from the boat. And they go across the lake, the Sea of Galilee. While they go across the lake, Jesus is bone tired, lays down, goes to sleep. The only time the Gospels actually ever tell us that Jesus slept. And then a storm comes up. Well, they wake Jesus up. He calms the storm. He teaches them a lesson about faith, and they're amazed that he's the Son of God. Okay, that's the story. Everybody probably remembers that story, pretty familiar. But we will interpret it better if we think a little bit about its genre. For instance, let me just drill down. First of all, it's in the Gospels, so it's a gospel genre. Second, it's a narrative, because it's a story. But thirdly, it's a miracle story. Those are a little different than just any old kind of story. Then there's dialogue. The disciples speak to Jesus. Jesus speaks to the disciples. The disciples respond kind of generically to one another and him. So there's dialogue. And finally, there's questions. Three questions. Interrogatives. They wake him up and say, "Lord, don't you care that we perish?" Then Jesus says, after calming the storm, at least in Mark's account, he says, "How is it that you have no faith?" Second question. The third question then is, after it's all calm, they say, "Who then is this that even the winds and the waves obey?" Once when I was trying to deal with the genre of this, my big idea came down to this. When we focus clearly on the object of our faith, then all our questions of faith will be resolved. So I was trying to take advantage that down deep in this story is really the interrogative, the question, which is a type of genre.
And what's fascinating to me, that sounds so complicated when you just sit there and think through one text, all these genres, how do I keep track? And I would just encourage you to understand this. You do this every day. Like when you are reading genre, when you're reading any literature, experiencing any kind of music or any kind of artwork, you are engaging multiple genres, even though you don't necessarily know it. Yet what's hard with the Bible is these are foreign genres. These are genres that you don't necessarily, you don't encounter on a regular basis. And so that's why we've said this a lot in this study. Broad scripture reading, consistent scripture reading is really the only way that you're going to be able to begin understanding the layers of genres that are there and present, not because the Bible is extra complicated than anything else, but because it uses genre like everything else. So just beware of that as you can engage this concept. So I can see how this can get, you know, complicated.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about give us some examples of some favorite texts where paying attention to genre really matters in interpreting those texts.
Yeah, glad to do that. And these would just be some of my more favorite ones. They could be a host of others. But for instance, Psalm 51:5 is King David in the Jerusalem Oval Office feeling rotten about his sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, the Hittite. And he says in verse 5, "In sin did my mother conceive me." Well, I doubt seriously that he's thinking about theology at that point. When does a person start to sin? When they're conceived? When they're born? Actually, after they grow up and make a bad choice? I don't think he's arguing theology. He feels lower than a schmuck, you know? And so the point is, it's poetic exaggeration. Be careful of using that to prove what's sometimes called the doctrine of original sin just because you're not paying attention to the poetic genre. Psalm 51:5. Here's another one. Revelation 13:1. John says, "And I saw a beast coming out of the sea." Well, you don't have to go any further to realize, whoa, what's this animal? And what kind of language is this? It's apocalyptic. It's symbolic. So I shouldn't even probably think about a literal beast. This is not Nessie up in northern Scotland coming out of Loch Ness, you know? This is a figure of speech.
I always heard it said, especially with apocalyptic literature, look for the natural interpretation, not the literal interpretation.
I think that's good. Yeah. We say we take it literally. Well, we actually do. We just don't take it literalistically.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Another one is Judges 14:14. I don't like Judges chapters 13 to 16 because they're about Samson. I don't much care for him. But Judges 14:14, he kills a lion, comes back later. Bees have made a hive in the carcass of the lion. He takes some of the honey out of it and gives it to his folks and him to eat. Well, they weren't supposed to do that, of course, according to Jewish law. But he created a poem, a riddle. Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet. You realize that's poetry. That's poetry. Another example, Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 4. He brought me to his banqueting table, and his banner over me is love. Well, I mean, I don't know all what's going on around there, but it looks like romance to me. 2 Corinthians 11, 7 and 8. This is an interesting one. Paul says to the church, or did I commit a sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted because I preached the gospel to you free of charge? Now listen to this next line. I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. Well, if you don't recognize that Paul's using sarcasm, it sounds like he's a thief. Mm-hmm. He robbed a church. So you have to realize that. Psalm 73, 3. This is a guy, Asaph, who feels like he's being drawn away from God, tempted to envy the wicked person down the street. He says, I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Who among us hasn't looked down the street and kind of envied our pagan neighbor? Hmm. But then he says, until I went into the sanctuary of God and got God's point of view. So it's just an honest admittance that, yeah, sometimes sin looks inviting. Mm-hmm. And in poetry, it's saying that to us. Or Psalm 137, 7 through 9. Where shall I go from your presence? Mm-hmm. Well, he's not asking the question so he can get there. He's saying, God's everywhere I've been and back. If I go to the heavens, he's there. If I go to Sheol, the grave, pit, death, there he is. In other words, he's talking about the omnipresence of God. He's not talking about trying to escape God. Mm-hmm. So it's poetry once again. Or I like this one from Jesus, Luke 13, 32. The Pharisees came to Jesus and said, you better get out of here. Herod's hunting you down. Herod's going to try to get you and kill you. And then Jesus says, you go tell that fox. Well, Jesus is not calling Herod a fox in a literal sense. He's using it that he's sly, he's cunning, just like we would use the word today. Mm-hmm. Those are some of my favorite ones.
That's good. Well, I know one of my favorite ones that I've actually had to use a few times to help correct somebody in their evangelistic efforts is, you know, Matthew 10, when Jesus gives instructions to the disciples on this missionary journey, he says, take nothing with you.
Yeah.
Don't take anything with you. And so I've had friends who go out and to do street evangelism,
yeah,
and they literally don't take anything with them. No phone, no cell phone, a wall. And I've had to talk to them the difference between a descriptive text,
yeah,
describing what happened, and a prescriptive text, which is telling us what should happen. Can you comment a little bit on the difference, even when we pay attention to genre, between descriptive and prescriptive?
Well, you're good at marking those out, Si, and those two labels, and they are so very important, especially if I could say this, if the listeners of this podcast grew up in the church like you and I did, mm-hmm, in the independent Christian church of what's typically called the Stone Campbell movement of American revivalism in the United States in the early 1800s. So if they have that kind of background, because this is kind of built into our DNA, mm-hmm, this is into our fabric. And sometimes, frankly, we've not been real good at distinguishing a descriptive text, mm-hmm, from a prescriptive text. It's kind of like, well, if it's good enough for Paul and Silas, it's good enough for me. Mm-hmm. And we just, in blind imitation, try to follow suit. So let me give an example or two. Maybe this will make some sense. The first person to be involved in polygamy, more than one wife, was Lamech. I wouldn't want to pattern my life after this dude. Mm-hmm. Okay, the Bible is accurate in portraying him boasting to his wives, plural. But that's not justification for polygamy. Mm. That text is descriptive. It's what he did, not what he should do. And so we have to remember that. A classic example in our background is Acts 20, verse 7. Now, I love our practice of taking the Lord's Supper every Sunday. I think it's rooted in strong church history. But really, the only frequency statements we have in the Bible about it is Jesus saying, as often as you do it. And then Acts 20, verse 7, that says, at least at Troas, they met together to break bread. It's a purpose clause. On the first day of the week. Now, frankly, we don't know if that's even Saturday night or Sunday night. But regardless, they did it. So it's a descriptive text. It's not telling us what we have to do. It's telling us what one of the examples of the early church did. Mm-hmm. It's descriptive, not prescriptive. Sometimes I'll joke with people when they want to get real legalistic about this, about having communion every Sunday, a tradition I like. But I'll say, well, then will you be the same way with the latter part of the verse? Because the latter part of the verse says, and Paul preached unto them until midnight. A lot of people say, well, wait a minute, we got to get to the restaurant, you know, and have dinner. So it just shows that you have to be really, really careful with description and prescription.
No, that's good. So understanding that there's a difference between those two.
Yeah.
Make sure not to confuse them. But when is it right to follow the descriptions of the new church and Jesus? And when do we imitate them? When do we follow their example?
That's really crucial, especially again in our heritage, because we're biblicists, we're primatists, we're restorationists. That is to say, we want to say, no, they had some things right back there, and we're going to go back there and be like them. So I think that's a presupposition that's pretty decent, quite frankly. But we do have to be careful. I think there are some things to follow, some examples to follow. 1 Corinthians 10:6 says that these things happened to the nation of Israel in the Old Testament as examples for us. So there must be some things we're to follow. One thing I like to think about this way is, in the context, principle we talked about earlier, in the context, is the context framing this event or this description up in such a way that you seem to get the approval of the author? Like, for instance, when Luke writes Acts 2, 42 to 47, man, it's just such a pristine view of the church. They met together to study the apostles' doctrine, to have fellowship, to break bread, to have prayers. They gave up their money. They took care of each other's needs. They evangelized. You just get the impression from the context, wow, Luke is trying to say, this is the church at its best. So when the context gives us the idea, yeah, this is a description you would want to follow. The other thing is what they did in that passage actually commanded in some other passage. Then that helps as well.
Which brings in parallel passages.
It does. It does, in fact. Sometimes we talk about this like this way. Precept, precedent, and then matters of faith and opinion. A precept is a command. A precedent might be a descriptive passage, and you may or may not have to follow it. Then matters of faith and opinion is on things that are essential, that really matter to the faith. Yeah, we've got to embrace those. On other things, there's a wide umbrella of opinion. Some things we can hold on tightly. Some things, Si, I think we need to just hold loosely. Genre is a great principle, and here's basically why. It helps us read the Bible on its own terms.
Mark, thank you so much for all of these sessions on this podcast on how to study the Bible. And thank you all so much for engaging this material over the last however many it has been days, or you did this all in one day, or you've been listening to it one week at a time. It's great having you with us. Go back and listen to these again if you thought one was a little cumbersome or you're need clarity as you're reading the Bible. These are ongoing resources you can use again and again and again. And remember, I think it's best, that last line, what you said for genre, is really the great way to sum it up. Read the Bible on its own terms. It was written by someone with a specific type of literature for a reason. So make sure you pay attention to that. Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you later. Have a good one.
Bye, everybody.